from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Former speechwriter for George W. Bush, David Frum, joins us to discuss his new book, Trumpocracy. A never-Trumper, the conservative-leaning Frum bemoans what he calls President Trump's full frontal attack on American norms and institutions.
President Trump right now is receiving millions of dollars in payments. We don't know how much. From businessmen in foreign countries, we don't know who. And none of this is known to the American public. And as the normal safeguards of American government go into effect, Trump is one by one turning them off to protect himself.
Coming up on Forum, we'll talk to David Frum about his book and the latest on the Russia investigation. That's next. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As a speechwriter for George W. Bush, conservative writer David Frum helped coin the term axis of evil. And leading up to the 2016 election, he railed against the Republican Party for failing to modernize or to grasp that income inequality and climate change were real problems that needed solutions. His new book is called Trumpocracy, and in it, he focuses on the dangers he says that President Trump represents to democracy, structural problems that led to the Trump win, and how the nation can recover. He joins us in studio for this hour to discuss the book and the political news of the day, and welcome, David Frum.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you with us. I guess the place to begin is to talk with you and get your take on it's being called the Nunes Memo. And let me just sort of set the stage here. President Trump has said it totally vindicates him from the Mueller investigation. Adam Schiff has said just the opposite. In fact, there's a Twitter battle that just went on this morning between, as I'm sure you're apprised, between President Trump and Adam Schiff. And I just wanted to have listeners know what President Trump said about Representative Nunes. He said he's a man of tremendous courage, this is just 2 hours ago, and grit, who may someday be recognized as a great American hero for what he has exposed and what he has had to endure. So what has he exposed exactly, and is this going to essentially be the vindication of Donald Trump, as he says?
Well, some listeners may recall the Monty Python sketch in which one of the characters presents a cat license, and he shows it to an inspector and says, that's not a cat license. That's a dog license with the word dog scratched out and the word cat written in crayon. And that's sort of what the Nunes memo is. It's a pretty shabby piece of work written by Republican staffers. It's a strange thing when you write the memo and then turn to yourself and say, I demand that I release the memo I just wrote. And as many astute observers have pointed out, that even within the Nunes memo, in fact, it is an incriminating, not an exculpatory document for President Trump. But I don't want to get dragged into this discussion because, in a way, you're pulled down a rabbit hole. The point of the Nunes memo was never to convince anybody. The point of the Nunes memo was to have a piece of paper with words on it that Sean Hannity could hold up as a talisman to say, okay, now you all have permission to ignore the facts.
And in fact, there is a Democrat memo that says the facts are very different. Now we have to find out whether that's going to be released. It has to get President Trump's approval.
But the conflict between these two memos takes us into a very Washington discussion where we get into hyper-precision over who said what at a hearing without regard to the larger context, which is there's no dispute that the Russians launched, beginning of 2015, a massive espionage and influence operation to help Donald Trump and bring him to the presidency. We don't know exactly why they wanted him so badly, although we can see the business connections. We can see other kinds of connections. We don't know exactly why they wanted, and we don't know exactly the nature of the communications between the Russians and the Trump campaign. Were they more or were they less? But we now know there were some communications between the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign was aware the Russians were helping them, and both privately at meetings at Trump Tower and publicly on the campaign welcomed that help. And since during the election and since that Donald Trump has advanced Russian interests
often, it's kind of gone under the radar, but we no longer have sanctions, in fact.
Well, we still have some sanctions. He has not been able to dismantle the pre-existing sanctions, but he has refused to implement new sanctions.
Exactly. And we also have the fact that, in fact, I want to get your thoughts about this. Carter Page was kind of connected to Russia going way back, despite what may be in the Steele dossier or not in the Steele dossier. It goes back to 2013, in fact, I think, is a strange man's connections to Russia.
Well, he is a strange man. He is, when you watch, we've all seen him on television and wonder why he does it. I mean, he's a singularly unimpressive person and seems kind of like clueless about the world around him. And that may be why the Russians, and maybe like a kind of reassuring news that the Russians are recruiting guys like this rather than scientists at Lawrence Livermore. But it's not a secret. I mean, it's on YouTube. You can watch him talking about being, an agent of the Russian state. So the question is, how does somebody like this, so obviously clueless and unintelligent and unimportant, become one of the five advisors that Donald Trump himself named as having five? And how is it that a second of those five is also someone with suspicious connections to Russia? That's 40%. I mean, that's really...
You're talking about Papadopoulos here?
Papadopoulos. Yeah. And then the three other advisors were in their turn as odd in their own ways.
It's also odd that on that FISA memo, there are names of all people who have presently either been removed from the FBI or resigned like McCabe did.
Yeah.
It almost seems like, by contrast, and I don't want to get too editorial about this, but Watergate happened very quickly with the Saturday Night Massacre. This is kind of happening one by one with the FBI.
Well, there are a lot of differences between Watergate and now. Perhaps the most important, though, was this, that the abuses that Nixon committed that we call Watergate were different in degree, but not in kind, from things that his predecessors had done before. Nixon was not the first president to try to get opponents' income tax returns. President Roosevelt had done that. Nixon was not the first to authorize surveillance of political opponents. Johnson had done that to Goldwater. Roosevelt had done that when he thought the Republicans might nominate Charles Lindbergh in 1940. And that's really the start of this practice. I mean, Roosevelt had excellent reason to worry about Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator, also a Nazi sympathizer. The United States is probably heading to war. And indeed, what the Germans did with Lindbergh in 1940 has some similarities to what the Russians did with Donald Trump. So these habits built up around the presidency got worse and worse and worse. Nixon took them to a whole new sub-basement of bad and then was caught at a time when the rules of American society were changing, when Americans were becoming less deferential to the presidency. And Watergate marked an end to a long period in which presidents had done things like this before. What's different about Donald Trump as compared to Nixon is no president has ever done anything like this. I mean, it really is as if Lindbergh had won in 1940.
Well, gone to war with the intelligence agency and the FBI and the judiciary. I mean, we've never seen anything like this in our history.
We've never had a scandal where the question about the president is his loyalty to the United States. And one of the things I cite in Trumpocracy, the book I wrote, is, you know, this is a problem that actually worried the founders of the country a great deal. At 1787, we know what they were talking about at the Constitutional Convention because James Madison kept notes. And there are two major discussions of impeachment, and both of them come up in the context of worrying, because the United States at the time is a fairly small and poor country. What if somebody big and rich like Spain or France or England tries to bribe the president? And the grandfathers and great-grandfathers of the authors of the Constitution had seen this happen back in England when Louis XIV of France put Charles II of England on his payroll. And they cited this at the convention. This is an example of what we are worried about with the presidency. And then they tried to reassure themselves that because of the safeguards in place, this wouldn't happen in the United States. And look, they had a pretty good run for 230 years. It didn't.
Well, we don't know at this point, as you point out in Trumpocracy, about where the money is going. We don't have, in fact, and I'm not only talking here about potential laundering of money. I'm talking about investments and ties to the Trump empire.
Yeah.
But even, I suppose, more profound than that in some ways, and you point this out as well, is the fact that we are completely, well, I was reading an interview you did in Slate, which I thought was really quite good, and you were making an analogy to the Rosenbergs.
Yeah. Well, here's...
As long as we're talking history, I mean, you know, this is pretty heavy-duty stuff when you talk about the Rosenbergs.
Well, there's a lot we don't know about the president's finances. So President Trump has not revealed his income tax returns. Every president since Jimmy Carter has released his complete income tax returns. And Gerald Ford, before Jimmy Carter, released a summary of his income tax returns. Presidents also have to fill must by law. The income tax return is optional, although maybe it shouldn't be anymore. But presidents must by law fill out a disclosure form, same as everyone else in the White House. But that disclosure form is set up to capture the financial affairs of normally prosperous Americans. It asks you about your debts. It asks you about your assets. And it asks you about your income sources. But if you are the beneficiary of a complicated stream of corporations and trusts, it doesn't ask you to report on all of the activity of all of those upstream entities. So Donald Trump, according to his best financial biographer, Timothy O'Brien, wrote a book about him in the early 2000s. Trump creates special purpose vehicles to hold his debts. He probably had, at that time, upwards of $1 billion of debt in special corporate entities. The form, the compulsory disclosure form, cannot begin to capture those. So we don't know what he owes. We don't know what Jared Kushner owes. And we don't know very much about their foreign income. Here's what we do know. There's a Trump Tower in Manila. There are two Trump Towers in Istanbul. And Trump didn't build them. He has a deal to let them use his name. They write him a check. We don't know how much that check is. We don't know whether it's a flat dollar amount or whether he's getting some kind of participation and so is an interest in the performance of the Philippines and Turkish economies. We don't know what percentage of his income that represents. Is it a small percentage or a huge percentage? We don't know about the Trump Towers in Buenos Aires. We don't know about the Trump Towers. There are four of them in India. He's receiving millions of dollars in payments from foreign business partners. And many of those foreign business partners, in turn, are dependent on foreign governments. I mean, Turkey is an increasingly authoritarian state. If you're a Turkish businessman, it's very important to you.
Well, forgive me, the point of your book is that the United States may be an increasingly authoritarian state as well.
Well, that's true. Led by, but in all of these cases, it starts with the financial corruption and it leads to the political corruption.
We're talking with David Frum. He's here with us in studio. He's the author of Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic, former speechwriter for George W. Bush, and now senior editor at The Atlantic. What is it that you have to say about all of your former Republicans? Really, pretty much, I'm talking about Congress representatives as well as senators lining up behind this president. Trey Gowdy now has come out and made some criticism, but he's not running against. Jeff Flake has made some criticism, but he's not running again. But for the most part, he has them all lined up, and you have people like Paul Ryan saying, well, you don't have to worry about the Mueller investigation, at the same time that he will come out and say, I'm behind the president on this Nunes memo and so forth. So, people are interested in your conversion. I mean, and how you deal with the former Republican colleagues of yours.
Well, I was asked not that my views matter, but as a matter of conversion, let me put it this way: if I were casting a vote for the California State Assembly, I'd vote Republican. I mean, if the question is should we have more taxes and more services or lower taxes and fewer services, I'm going to vote for, you know, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative. I want to see business more lightly regulated, that kind of thing. But I want to do that within a constitutional framework because it's as important to me to protect the rights of people who disagree with me when my guys are in charge as I care about having my rights protected. You know, during the Obama years, I disagreed with most of the things that Obama was doing. But, you know, it never occurred to me that I had to worry about how I set, you know, and I could be kind of rude or even uninformed, unfair in the
you
way.
You mean they didn't have to worry about the institutions and the rule of law and those kinds of things.
So I could say unfair, abusive, ill-informed things about President Obama. And that was, by God, as an American, it is my right to talk without knowing what I'm talking about. So it's the constitutional system. And also, by the way, I never doubted that President Obama was living on his salary as president of the United States and his book royalties. I didn't have to worry that he's on the payroll of some foreign government. So when he did something I didn't like, I knew he was doing it for his own reasons. And I knew that when the Democratic majority in Congress that was there for 2 years supported him, they were doing it for their own reasons because they tended to agree with him, not because he was putting improper pressures on them. The American political system worked. And that's, you know, none of us, as this is one of the reasons why we give the vote only to adults, is you get the vote when you learn you don't always get your own way in life. And you have to expect that, you know, you're going to get your own. If you get your own way a little more than half the time, you're doing pretty well. So I haven't had some conversion experience. I mean, these are one of the things that goes on in the Trump years. Economists have this concept, revealed preference, where you reveal what your priorities are. Given, you know, you've got $100 in your pocket, you've got two things that each cost $100, you can only buy one, which do you choose? And we're learning something about, so these are, I am not changing my political commitments, but I am reaffirming my constitutional and my moral commitments. Meanwhile, my Republican friends are letting their political commitments overtake and overturn their political, their constitutional and their moral commitments.
Overturn to the extent that they are going to stand behind this president regardless of what may come out of the Mueller investigation?
I think that's, you know, when you begin to walk down a path, you don't, you can often hide from yourself where you're going. And you take one step and it doesn't seem so bad. And you take another and you talk yourself into the idea, well, this is necessary. Maybe it won't be as bad as it looks. So I don't think anyone, I don't think Paul Ryan started this by saying, I am going to protect Donald Trump from the findings of the Mueller investigation, no matter what they are. He must have had in mind, well, if they're really bad, of course, at that point, I'll do something. But I just hope they won't be so bad. But as we go, and every time we learn something, and each is worse than the thing we learned before, at each step, people make the moral decision. And I think we're at a point now where the Republicans are really in a position where, even if they don't yet entirely know this themselves, they've put themselves on a path where they have no choice but to ignore whatever Mueller finds. What we already know is the worst foreign influence scandal in American history.
Well, it may be too much of the analogies to Watergate, but in Watergate, you know, there were Republicans who certainly seemed much more open-minded than Republicans. I mean, Howard Baker's often mentioned, for example, and there were others who didn't seem to necessarily go along with what President Nixon was doing and were able to challenge him and certainly able to be formidable in some ways opponents of his.
The party system worked differently then. But let me say a word for the defenders of Nixon during Watergate. Because one of the underlying defenses, one of the things that really sort of undergirded a lot of the Republican attitude to Nixon was they knew that Lyndon Johnson had wiretapped Barry Goldwater in the 1964 campaign. And so they thought, oh, okay, so when your guy does it, it's fine. I mean, we all agree no one should do it. But your guy, we didn't find out about it until after the election was all over and it was too late. And we could never 100% prove it, but we strongly smelled it. So there was that. But what was happening now with Donald Trump is we are dealing with behaviors that have never been seen in the American presidency. Never. There are no precedents. It's not like Nixon is an exaggerated. You take all, you know, abuses that Roosevelt did, abuses that Kennedy did, abuses that Johnson did. You double them or triple them. That's Nixon. But none of, very little of it was unprecedented. What is happening now is we have never had a president in the thrall of a hostile foreign power in this way. We've never had a president run a I mean, Lyndon Johnson ran his radio station when he was president, and that was troubling to a lot of people. And something that a lot of then the post-Watergate consensus said he should never have done. But it was a radio station in this case, and it was located in America. And it was in a competitive market. In this case, you've got millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions, who knows, flowing from international partners, and it's maybe 1% of the president's income, maybe 10, maybe 40. Who knows?
Well, as long as you're talking about historical precedents and analogies to Watergate and the like, what are your thoughts on the fact that you hear from the left now, for example, that the president is at war with the FBI, we need the FBI, and the FBI is sacred and so forth. At the same time, that there was all this criticism for many years about actions of the FBI, particularly against the left, and actions against Martin Luther King and wiretapping him and so forth. I mean, in some ways, this isn't unprecedented, and yet it is, with the president standing firmly against the FBI or seemingly wanting to get rid of now Rosenstein, I imagine.
Well, I end Trumpocracy with an optimistic chapter, and it's not just tacked on because – I mean, I've been very much involved in this fight, but you meet a lot of new kinds of people and you see a lot of new kinds of things. And there's a lot I've seen in the past year. I started the book in a very dark place in January 2017, and I ended in sort of a more excited place because just the people I met along the way. And I end the book by talking about these strange gifts of Donald Trump. And one of them is, I think we're moving to a really new chapter in American history. I mean, for me, someone with my background, look, I remember arguing to people on the left, Julian Assange is not a hero. Edward Snowden is not a hero. And the institutions they are attacking, a democracy needs. And it's heartening to me to see people on the left waking up and saying, you know what? We need the, yeah. Because foreign enemies do not always attack you with rockets and tanks. Sometimes they use cyber techniques, and you need clandestine security services to protect your society and your democracy against those things. And I have seen increasingly among some of my dissenting friends on the right a recognition that, you know, there are a lot of if you're on the right, one of your mental attitudes, there are a lot of casual unfairnesses of life. They don't take that seriously. People should shake them off, you know. What Donald Trump takes a lot of those casual unfairnesses toward women, toward minority groups, and he just puts them on this giant jumbotron in the middle of the town square and forces you to watch them at huge magnification nonstop. And suddenly a lot of things that you could say, well, those are just microaggressions, when the president's doing them, they become kind of macro and they're ugly. And you don't want to see them.
So your hope is maybe vested in the fact that, and there were a lot of people like you who were very critical of Obama. They saw perhaps the election of Donald Trump as a reaction against Obama. Maybe what we're going to see next is a reaction against Donald Trump. This thing vacillates.
But I hope to see it. I hope to think of it as something more than a pendulum swing. Because I think what is happening now is so disturbing in so many ways. I'm looking for a kind of civic recovery. You know, I think in many ways we've been having the same arguments in American politics for a long time, maybe for a quarter of a century. Same arguments by the same people. And it may be that Donald Trump has just done so much damage to the structures of American politics that if we get through this and remain a functioning society, we will be in a new landscape.
Well, that's a big if. I mean, it could be irreparable, but you're saying you're optimistic it won't be.
Well, no, so I think
the resilience of the American.
No, I'm not saying that. This is a hope, not a prediction. I don't make predictions because the only way you can make predictions is if you're looking at this like a spectator. I feel I'm a participant, but I feel both dread and hope. And I can tell you the things I dread, and I can tell you the things I hope. And I do think some of the damage will be irreparable. I mean, I think that, for example, the U.S.-South Korean alliance is irreparably damaged, that we have behaved, from their point of view, when I say we, I mean the president and his government, have behaved so recklessly toward them that they have to make their own arrangements. They cannot, when your protector is talking about waging a preemptive nuclear strike against your nuclear-armed neighbor that will, you know, cost you hundreds of thousands of casualties, but at least your protector will be safe. You have to say, I think I need a new protector. And I don't think that the South Koreans will ever be able to unthink the thoughts they've had over the past year.
Let me remind listeners that we are talking with David Frum. He's here with us in studio. He's senior editor of The Atlantic. His new book is called Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. And we invite your calls and your emails. He was the former speechwriter for George W. Bush. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, the number for you to call, 866-733-6786, to be part of the program. You can also let us know your thoughts or any questions you might have for our guests by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And we'll return with your calls and emails and your thoughts. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is David Frum. He's here with us in studio. He's senior editor of The Atlantic and author of Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. He's also a former speechwriter for former President George W. Bush. And here's a tweet from SK who says, as a conservative, what's David Frum's opinion on the new tax plan and what are his thoughts on the fact that many conservatives have gotten behind Trump on this? Well, we've kind of intimated some of your thoughts on that and so forth. But that was really what the conservatives wanted almost above all, wasn't it? And they want many of the policies they feel that he can use him as a vehicle for.
Yeah. Look, I'm pretty sympathetic to what was done on the corporate side. I don't like I think the individual side was a bunch of giveaways, but the corporate side, I'm a Republican. I think it's better to collect less from the corporate income tax, and I would like to see more from, you know, excise tax. That's what we used to talk about. And one of the things that people say to me, on the Twitter. This is actually my favorite thing to hear from people, is when they understand that we think differently, and they say, "I'm so looking forward to when you and I can go back to arguing about regulation and taxes again." I say, "Me too. Let's get back to that."
Lisa writes, "Doesn't direct election and political appointment of judiciary and law enforcement posts naturally undermine the idea that law strives to be based on principles above partisanship, and isn't the drive to control the Supreme Court at the heart of the current crisis?"
But presidents have historically made their choice. Of course, yes, there's always been politics in American law enforcement. And maybe this is a bad thing. Like in other countries, the equivalents of the U.S. attorneys are not patronage appointments in other countries. They are in the United States. But what has historically happened is this is where this famous concept of norms comes in. When President Obama gave a speech to his first group of U.S. attorney nominations, he said to them, "I appointed you, but you do not work for me." So the idea has always been for these people, they're selected from a certain kind of talent pool. And some of them happen to be Democrats and some of them happen to be Republicans, but they are more loyal to their common identity as very high-skilled, high-quality lawyers. And they look for approval not to a party machine but to their peers. And so, they have opinions. Who doesn't? But they have tried to work within a context of legal integrity. A lot of that has been breaking down as the partisanship in American society has gotten worse. And President Trump has intruded himself by having direct control. I mean, he's been interviewing candidates for the U.S. attorney job. That's a different kind of thing.
Well, when you mentioned partisanship and you talk about possibly being going back to the good old days when people were arguing about tax reform and the like,
yeah.
Axios poll just came out and it shows that there are about 60% of Democrats who feel that that the Nunes menu, just to use that as an example, doesn't reveal anything relevant to the Mueller investigation, whereas it's only about 30-some percent of the Republicans who feel that
yeah.
way. I mean, this is a great divide.
Right. I have a lot of examples of that in the book, about how partisanship influences how we think about things. You can see it changing people's minds. I mean, you can in real time, and I have a stat on this in the book, how Republicans went from hating Vladimir Putin to liking him. And too late to include in the book, there's some new polls that show Republican respect for the FBI has collapsed under the pressure from Donald Trump.
That's the Axios poll, in fact, yeah.
But I don't agree that we have different perspectives. I think it's okay to say that people are wrong or mistaken. And one of the – we talked earlier about gifts of Trump. One of the gifts of Trump has been, a new respect among many for the importance and preciousness of truth and for being able to uphold truth. Used to be that the phrase post-truth, which we hear so much, began in the academy as a compliment, not a criticism. And there's something oppressive about the idea of a single truth. We were going to have multiple truths derived from people's different ethnicities and experiences. You would have your truth. I would have my truth. Who could say who was right?
But it wasn't until Kelly Conway we had alternate facts.
Right. But what we have, I think, learned from the Trump years is that the opposite of truth is not truths. The opposite of truth is lying, and democracies cannot be sustained under endless official lying.
Well, there's the other argument. We become so inured to lying that it will affect us in the long run.
Well, that's the chance. But that's a real risk, and it is for that reason that we have to uphold the preciousness of truth. And more people, I think, are talking about that way and saying, you know what? There is truth. There are not just truths.
Think the government's going to shut down, David?
The government shut down for 3 days. That was a huge tactical error by the Democrats, I have to say. And there was a trap and they walked into it. And it's an example of one of the assets that Donald Trump has, is that the interests of the people who want to be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020 differ from that of the Democratic Party as a whole. The way you get an early lead in the 2020 presidential nomination is by locking up progressives. And so they're battling to control the left wing of their party. And they're dragging the whole party, because this battle among the 2020s is dragging the whole party to the left in a way that is dangerous for the whole party. So to have a government shutdown over the status of Dreamers, that may be great if you're Elizabeth Warren battling whoever she's battling. But if you're Claire McCaskill in St. Louis, your national party just dealt your campaign a hammer blow. So one of the things it's not my business to give advice to Democrats and they wouldn't listen to me, but I would tell them just you have to be mindful that there's a bigger game here and that you have to remember that both the opportunity and the duty that comes from the Trump fiasco is to think of yourself as a broad national party of wide-ranging views and not a place where people compete to be the most ideological. That's a path to winning a nomination. It's not a path to winning an election or even more governing the country.
Well, by contrast, Republicans have seemed to have taken a pretty firm toehold now in terms of wanting to get rid of it's unclear what they want on DACA, but they want the wall. Trump wants the money for the wall. They want to get rid of what they're calling chain migration, what people call family unity and the visa rule and so forth. In other words, they've got a list, a kind of a laundry list that they're pushing very hard.
Yeah. Well, not pushing. I would say that they're pushing it very hard because actually, the wall's the wall is not really an idea. The wall is a Trump symbolic victory. At this point, even when Trump started talking, 25% of illegal immigrants entered the country by air on a visa they overstayed. Today, I understand that visa overstays make up 40% of new additions to the illegal immigrant population. So the wall is not an answer to that problem. So even if you take that problem very seriously, and I do, you say, how is building concrete structure through marshland in the untraversed parts of the Rio Grande going to help us make sure that when somebody enters the country on a student visa, that they leave when they should?
We also have many people coming in by plane, obviously,
right,
and staying here, period.
It's about 40% at this point.
Yeah. I want to go to our callers. Let me first, because you mentioned Sean Hannity's role in the memo, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about the role of Fox News. Is it, as you see it, it's a conservative network, but why has it gone all in for Trump? Is this ratings or is this ideology, do you think?
Well, I chronicle in the book that one of Trump's first victories was his victory over Fox News. Fox News, he had a long relationship with Fox News. It was very chummy. He had a friendship with Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly. But Rupert Murdoch had resolved in 2015 that he wanted Fox to play a part in selecting a Republican candidate. And he was a big Chris Christie booster. He liked Scott Walker. And when Trump appeared, Fox, although they gave him a lot of airtime because he was good fun and good ratings, at the first Fox debate, they sent out their three most professional then anchors, Megyn Kelly, Chris Wallace, and Bret Baier, and they gave Trump an extremely hard time. And Trump reacted as he does. He refused to go on again. He directed all of his anger at the woman, of course, at Megyn Kelly, and he broke Fox to his will. He boycotted a Fox debate. He did his famous fundraiser for the veterans, which he kept the money for a long, long time until it was beaten out of him. Fox was constrained in much the same way that the Congressional Republican Party has been constrained by the discovery that its base, like Donald Trump, better than it did Fox's own leadership.
Let's bring our callers on, and we begin with a caller from San Francisco. Brian, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I have a question. The guest believes that the Congressional Republicans are supporting Trump because they believe in him, or, he's a Republican, he'll, have them push forward their agenda, or they're scared that they won't get reelected because his base is their base, and if they go against Trump, then they'll lose in future elections.
Great question from the caller. I talk about this in Trumpocracy. The answer is all of the above, depending on different people and in different proportions. There are genuinely Trump true believers in the Congressional Republican Party, and over time there will be more. As they lose moderates, as they lose seats in New Jersey and California, there will be more Trump true believers, and he's also affecting changing the future of the party. But I would say Trump true believers remain a very distinct minority within the Congressional Republicans and a tiny minority within the Senate Republicans. Many of them have a cynical view that they can do business with him and get things from that they want. That's certainly the view of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, who clearly do not have any affection for Donald Trump and would regard themselves as very different kinds of people. But they think they can do business with them. And what they don't understand is that he's been getting more out of them than they've gotten out of them. But in that case, at least, it's a pact of opportunism. But increasingly, what they are seeing is he is so legally vulnerable, both from financial point of view and national security point of view, that if they don't protect him, it's going to be really bad, not only for him, but for them. And so,
and for the country.
Actually, if they don't protect him, it would be good for the country. Well, and things would come to light and people would
do
something.
If they don't protect him, right.
But so they're on a path of saying, we are now, in a way, hostages of Donald Trump. That the guiltier he looks, the stronger he gets, because his party becomes more dependent on him. And after 2018, should they lose one or the other or both houses of Congress, he will be the only game in town, and they'll have to protect him even more as they and he become more unpopular together.
Well, he's discrediting and impeding this Mueller investigation. He's got a whole new narrative all about the deep state and all the rest of it. And I mean, to some extent, even though they belie it, Ryan particularly getting out there and saying no, after everything has to move forward, everything they do to some extent pretty much supports.
Donald Trump, like everybody, I read the Michael Wolff book with fascination and interest, and I think much of it is true or true enough. But he gets some important things wrong. In a way, and the things he gets wrong are really dangerous mistakes, because he presents Trump as a kind of helpless, pitiful, idiotic dotard. And that will make people complacent. For everything that is properly part of the job of the president, yeah, Trump is just as lazy and indifferent and checked out as Wolf says. But for the things a president should not do, Trump is shrewd and active.
You think he's pretty cunning, in fact.
I think he's very wily. And I think he has a will to power unlike any president ever. And that's why even some of the most formidable people in the U.S. government, General H.R. McMaster, a hero of Iraq and Afghanistan, Trump, they end up yielding to Trump's superior will to power.
They say the only one who has it is Mattis. Do you believe that? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that so far. But Mattis is across the river. He's managing a giant bureaucracy.
But Robert Ray didn't succumb either. He was a Trump appointee. I mean, he stood up against his Nunes menu.
We'll see how long the FBI holds up. Because what Trump is going to do is perforate it and put in subordinate people and drive out one by one the people he doesn't like. We'll see the FBI. So long as Mattis is at the Department of Defense, I think the Pentagon remains. But the Pentagon is a separate domain. And in the end, it also is an order-taking institution, much more than the FBI. So they get a direct order from Donald Trump. It will be a different kind of challenge. The FBI is supposed to worry a lot about whether the president's orders are appropriate. The military is supposed to just, unless the orders
follow the orders of the commander-in-chief.
Yeah, that's in their DNA.
Let me bring some more callers aboard here. Dan is next. Dan, you're on.
Yes, good day. I'm a Bay Area liberal Democrat. I read your column all the time.
Thank you. I find your
comments insightful. I do have a serious disagreement with you. I'm not sure if you've ever come out and said it, but it appears that you view Trump as sui generis, as sort of a thing in and of itself, whereas I think that Trump is a logical extension of the paranoid style of Republican politics going mainstream. It used to be John Birchers and wackos were on the fringe. Then you had a gradual march towards more and more acceptable behavior within the Republican Party and a conservative movement of this sort of just ignoring reality, sticking by the facts. And I would put it back in the 90s, and I would say that your carrying water for the Bush administration had a lot to do with that. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I don't think Trump comes from nowhere, but I don't think he comes from the place you do. I open the book with a description of ways in which I think just generally the American political system has been radicalizing since the end of the Cold War and especially since 9/11. And Iraq War and Bush v. Gore were part of that story, but they're not all of that story. So I think that Trump is an opportunistic infection. A stronger system would have shaken him off.
He's not the natural consequence of the Tea Party and all the right-wing leaning of the Republican Party?
He didn't have to be. He didn't have to be. In a healthier political system, he would not have been. He is the consequence of those things, yes, but it's not inevitable. I'm not a big believer in political inevitabilities. If we had done a better job, and when I say we, I mean those who, whether because of leisure or economic advantage or educational opportunity, those who have, you know, more influence on the American political system had done a better job of caring for the society would not have been vulnerable to him. And I think it took a lot of failures. Military failure in Iraq is part of the story. So is the failure of America to even notice the opioid epidemic as it started to ravage the country in 2014. I talk in the book about how little attention that this epidemic got in its first 2.5 years. You know, among Americans who did not go to college, life expectancy is declining. Now, that is something that did not happen during the Great Depression. Didn't happen. It's never happened in any advanced country in peacetime ever. Didn't happen in Germany during the Great Depression when people were literally starving. It's only happened in the United States among non-college graduates and in the post-Soviet Union. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around. I think I would generally say I do not agree with you that this is a fault of the Republican Party. I think it's a fault of upper-class America, Republican and Democrat, that has become, maybe because of the fading of the memory of World War II, maybe because of the fading of the dangers of the Cold War, upper-class America has become generally more remote and indifferent to non-upper-class America.
Bring another caller on. Jack, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Sure. My father had an eighth-grade education. He was a staunch Republican, and I'm not. How are we going to approach the group that Trump got so excited about by saying how much he loved the uneducated? Yeah. How are we going to get them to listen to all of the stuff that you've been talking about, which I believe?
Yeah.
Actually, let me add something to that, because I'm looking at a listener here who says, aside from voting, what's the most important action we citizens can take to reverse the damage that has been done to U.S. norms and institutions over the past 10 years?
Okay. Those are great questions, and I will not be able to do justice to all of them in the short time on the radio, but let me – a couple of points. For the point of view of this, the strict political matter, you do not defeat bad presidents by changing the minds of their base. That's why they were called the base. 1932 – in the middle of at the bottom of the Great Depression, Herbert Hoover still got 38% of the vote. And no one worried, well, how do we change the minds of all of those people who think, I don't like the Depression, but at least he's good on prohibition? You didn't worry about those people. You beat presidents by changing soft voters. So the way you take away Trump's personal power to do harm is not by talking to coal miners or white supremacists or people like that. You do it by talking to college-educated white mothers in the suburbs of Philadelphia and Milwaukee and the greater Detroit area. If you just you need to change to get a lot of women who voted for Mitt Romney and to persuade them that you made it, of course you did the right thing, but you thought one way in 2016, think a different way in 2020, and you changed the votes of a few hundred thousand college-educated white mothers in the right states, and Trump will no longer be president.
It's interesting you're saying white mothers, because we've been hearing a lot about black mothers, particularly when Roy Moore was defeated and black women getting together and mobilizing and getting out. I mean, Obama probably, if he ran again, would have won because he would have had the black vote that obviously didn't go behind the Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, and you have to get that vote to really bring the Democrats.
But Alabama is, 40% black? And so if you can mobilize black voters, that's a lot of people. Whereas the upper Midwest is about 15 or less percent black. So the mobilization would have to be superhuman. If you want to beat them, if you apply the maximum of pressure at the most vulnerable pressure point, that's how presidential politics works. That's how you beat them. That's only goes to how do you do that? You don't fix the society. And that is a deeper discussion, which I talk about in the book.
Scott writes, Trump ran on the wall. He won. Just because you disagree with that and think it ineffective, don't his voters have some mandate of political capital? And sort of tied to that, another listener says, 5 years of surveillance on Carter Page, 3 FISA warrants, 0 charges. Carter Page must be the cleanest man in America.
Okay. So 2 things.
Kind of welded those together a bit.
Yeah. So let me say something about – I'm going to answer the first question a little bit more generally. My view of politics is this. It's the job of voters to identify problems, and it's the job of politicians to compete to offer solutions. And you get into trouble when politicians refuse to hear voters about what the problems are, and you get into trouble when you have these populist impulses about what the solutions are. So the right thing is for voters to say, illegal immigration, we're really concerned about it, and we haven't been heard. And you politicians had better pay attention. Where you get into trouble is when you get a group of voters who say, and the stupid wall idea is the right answer. Let the professionals compete to offer you answers. When you're buying any product, you don't tell the company how to design the product. You say, what I want is a phone that actually makes calls and doesn't drop them. You guys work on that. And that's my approach to politics. As to Carter Page being the cleanest man in American politics. Counter-espionage is not about filing charges. It's about neutralizing threats to the country. And the reason you do this through the FISA process is the whole point of it is not to bring charges. Security threats are not the same as criminal threats. It's to identify threats and to protect the organs of state from those threats.
And those FISA warrants were actually submitted by both the Obama and the Trump administration.
Yeah, but FISA warrants use evidence that would not be admissible in a regular court. That's why we have a FISA court. It's not a criminal process. It's not leading to criminal charges.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking again with David Frum. He's here with us in studio. His new book is called Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. He's a former speechwriter for George W. Bush and now senior editor of The Atlantic. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. And I'm going to go to another caller, and James, that's you. You're on the air, James. Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mr. Frum, I just want to say I'm a fan of yours. I appreciate what guys like you and Bill Kristol are doing, trying to guide the Republican Party back to where it should be. My question for you is, do you foresee the Republican Party being able to return to kind of the values that it once stood for, or do you think it's going to continue to pull farther right? And if you do think it can come back, kind of what steps do you think Republican leadership and Republicans in general need to take to get back to kind of that semblance of normalcy? And if they can't do that, do you foresee the potential of possibly a third political party rising?
You're getting a lot of questions along those lines, James. Right, thank you. Conservative Party.
So one of my life mottos is think like a pessimist, act like an optimist. So I have no idea whether the kinds of things that people like me and Bill Kristol and others are trying to do, I have no idea whether we'll succeed. And possibly we won't, but I'm still going to keep doing it because, here's what I do believe. First, we're conservative people. We don't agree with liberals and Democrats about how the country should be run. So we need our own party. I don't believe in, let me put it this way. If Google and Facebook got together and said, instead of competing with one another, we're going to work together for the benefit of our customers, you would know a scam was on the way. You want to see the most vigorous possible competition for your attention to make your consumer sovereignty meaningful. And in the same way, that's politics. You want people to be disagreeing and competing, but competing according to rules and within a constitutional and patriotic context. I also think it's very important. I think that people say, aren't you concerned that the Republican Party is moving in an anti-democratic direction? I say, yes. So they say, why are you there? I said, because I'm concerned they're moving in an anti-democratic direction. That it's no good to have one party that is committed to democratic processes and one that is not. You need two parties that are committed to democratic processes. And so that's another reason to stay inside. So there are no guarantees that you're going to succeed. And if you only act when you know you're going to succeed, then you might as well take the day off because no one needs you. You're needed when you don't know whether you're going to succeed or not.
Let me bring another caller aboard here while we have a few moments with our guest, David Frum. And Charles is our next caller. Charles, hi.
Good morning. Hi. I worry that we've come to a point where a politically biased source can't be used to obtain a warrant. And also that I don't hear that it being discussed that, you know, those involved, maybe they've developed preferences during the 2016 election because they were privy to intelligence.
Yeah. Okay, two interesting points the caller makes, and he's raising a question that you hear a lot from people. So I would say, first, if it's true that people in the FBI, as they investigated Donald Trump, starting off in most of them as people who were more conservative and in many cases as Republicans, became so horrified by what they learned about his Russia connections that they became strenuous anti-Trump partisans. That's not an argument in defense of Donald Trump. You know, I take people who are biased in my favor, I show them the facts, and they come to realize that they would vote for Hillary Clinton in order to stop me. That's not a good argument. I showed this actually to my mother, and when she saw the evidence, she said, Donnie, you shouldn't be president. Like, no, the fact that people are inclined to be against your opponent, see the evidence against you, and then come to support your opponent, that's pretty damning. As the claim that is made that you cannot start with a tip, obviously you do not wiretap somebody on the say-so of a political opponent. But if a tip from a political, if you say it's illegitimate even to take a tip as a way to begin looking at evidence, there's never going to be any law enforcement in the United States ever again. I mean, every white-collar crime, or almost everyone, begins with a tip from an ex-wife, a disgruntled former employee, an embittered business partner. The police do not get their information about you from people who like you. They get their information from people who have reason to dislike you. But the police also know, you know, of course you take the ex-wife's information with a grain of salt. But if you hear the tip, if she says, I have evidence that that my ex-husband committed a serious crime, police say, okay, grain of salt here, but let's take a look. Holy moly, he really did. the fact that it started with information from the ex-wife does not discredit it.
Well, here's some credit to you, David Frum. I'm going to end on this. This is Pamela who writes, I'm thankful for the perspective of your guest. As a progressive, I'm increasingly listening to thoughtful conservatives like him with great interest and appreciation. The recent revealing of the Nunes memo and apparent attempts to discredit our intelligence agencies, I'm becoming more and more terrified about our national and international security. Mm-hmm. Good note to end on. Thank you, David Frum. And again, David Frum's book is, and it's out and it's available, is called A Kingdom, it's called Trumpocracy, the Corruption of the American Republic. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. When we return, we'll be with George Saunders, who has won the Man Booker Award for fiction this year. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.